But let me now introduce the first of our panellists. Professor Nikki Ellis is an occupational and public health physician, the inaugural president of the Australasian Faculty of Occupational and Environmental Medicine. The personal injury compensation sector has been a consistent thread for the past 20 years, whether that is as a consultant or chairing the New South Wales Medical Advisory Committee for the then New South Wales WorkCover Authority, or leading the establishment of the Institute for Safety Compensation and Recovery Research at Monash University. Her book, Work and Health Management in Australia and New Zealand, is still used in training in occupational health and safety today. Would you please welcome Professor Nikki Ellis.
Thank you very much, Tracy, and thank you, Rowan Davies and Aaron Cutter, for organising this session. Theoretically, my title is meant to be The Theory of Health Outcomes and Their Impact on Workers' Comp or something like that, but I took some licence with that, as you can see here. But I think this is a very important subject, and I'm delighted to see it on the agenda for this august body. What I really want to start by saying is performance in workers' comp has completely flatlined. And we heard this morning in a presentation, Alan Clayton put a graph up showing return to work performance that Safe Work Australia's published, and that's completely flat and has been for the past 5 years. Most of us in this room, what was that? 15 years. Thanks, Alan. And for musculoskeletal disorders, that's completely flat, flat as a pancake. We've really run out of successful tricks in our toolbox there. And as Paul O'Connor was talking about this morning, mental health claims are going up. So we're in trouble. And today what I want to argue is that our schemes and our approach, which is based on a traumatic injury model, is drowning in chronic illness. And we need to develop a new model which can cope with the complexity, again a term that Paul used in his presentation this morning, something that can cope with the complexity of the reality of the fact that causation of illness involves multiple risk factors, not single risk factors. I want to start with this terrific slide that my colleague and friend Anne-Marie Fayer presented recently. It's from the Australian Institute of AIHW. And you can see here that on one side we've got the profile of disability, so it's the prevalence of disability years lost, and we have the graph in 1993 and then the predicted graph for 2023. And if you just look at the working age years, you can see what's going on. And in this graph, she's highlighted diabetes. So in 1993, that's a fairly slim line in the working age population, and by 2023, that's a fairly fat line. So this is the problem we've got. We've got chronic illness washing through the working population, chronic illness therefore washing through our schemes. So the gist of what I want to say today is the time has come to put the H back into occupational health and safety. When I was getting my slides loaded on this morning, the person who was helping looked up and said, shouldn't that be workplace health and safety? And of course it should be, so apologies. Everyone's an expert. I was very grateful for the feedback. This is the gist of what I want to say today, but of course it's the gist of what I've been saying for about 20 years. And in fact, some of the slides that I'll be using today are from my book that was published in 2001. So these are not new ideas, but it's very pleasing to see that there's a receptiveness to them just at the moment. Okay. I'm quite intrigued by this fact. I'm quite intrigued by the fact that this idea that a model based on trauma only is sufficient, and that despite the fact that there's been quite a lot of evidence for quite a long time, I'm fascinated by the fact that we've just resisted that and we've just pressed on with doing what we've always done. So I started to look for some evidence around that and to see what people were writing about that. And I found this fascinating PhD from 1985. So it was written when this woman, Jane Stapleton, was a young woman from ANU doing her PhD. And she very carefully articulated this question of injury and disease. And so you can see here, you may not be able to read the writing, but there's a little bobble on the side. And that's really, she's called that accidents. And then she's divided the bigger circle into man-made disease and natural disease. And in the treatise, she really explores the differences. She acknowledges that fitting disease into the scheme is very difficult for all the reasons that we know, that diseases, work-related diseases, result from exposures over a long period of time, from multiple exposures. But she says that that doesn't really, in her view, explain everything. And she thinks that as a sector, we've become rather enculturated, that the walls had kind of gone up and we'd become a little comfortable in doing what we've always done. And so this is the model that we have been working on for the past, forever, really. And so the features of the model you'll see here in health. It's common to separate health protection from health promotion. So health protection is the minimisation of harm, and health promotion is efforts to promote health and well-being. And in occupational health and safety, we've been very clearly fixed on health protection. It's a health protection model. It's based on the fact that we have a mandated responsibility for employers to provide a safe and healthy working environment. And you can see there that there are figures there with negative next to them because we operate in a negative construct. We're trying to minimise harm. And then you'll see that there's the blue blob, and that's really the physical environment. And pretty much everything we've done in our field has focused on the physical environment. We've acknowledged that the psychosocial environment, that is the way work is organised and the way people are managed, is important, but we've done absolutely nothing about it in terms of our interventions by and large. And so when health started to raise its ugly head and people began to realise that there were illnesses as well as injuries, we kind of pushed that over in the side. And in the 80s, we invented health promotion in the workplace. And we said that health promotion in the workplace was the responsibility of the worker as opposed to the employer, and that we dealt with that at an individual level rather than an environmental level. So employers would support workers to make their own behavioural change. And the most important thing about this model is we just assumed that you could divide conditions into work-related conditions and non-work-related conditions. And that sort of worked for a while when we had a lot of traumatic injuries. Obviously, that works very well. You're very able to determine a work-related injury. And we kind of had honorary diseases that behaved like injuries with single risk factors. So we said noise-induced hearing loss, we can shoehorn that in. Maybe asbestos, that's pretty much a single risk factor, we can shoehorn that in. And then what about coronary heart disease and diabetes? We said, that's over there. That's all to do with non-work-related risk. I'm amazed we got away with that as long as we did. The reality is that we've known that psychosocial risk factors have contributed to coronary heart disease since the 1960s. There's mounting evidence that psychosocial occupational stress factors contribute to diabetes. But we've really come undone with musculoskeletal disorders and mental health. If you talk to people in workplaces now, these are the biggest conditions that people are worried about. These are the most prevalent conditions that people are dealing with, musculoskeletal disorders and mental health problems. And people can see it's a mixture. You know, you can't really separate one or the other. So our model's really coming undone big time now and being challenged. So why have we resisted for so long? I've been fascinated with future studies methodologies for some time now. I'm working with Sahail Eniatullah, who's one of the leading futurists in the world. And one of the theories in future studies is that we have very deeply held beliefs that determine our behaviour sometimes. And when you see something that's not changing, you need to dig deep to understand what the real barriers are. And I wondered whether there might be some of those in the way we think in our sector. And so I went back to Roy Porter, who's one of the best history of medicine academics that we've seen in recent times. And I was working at the Wellcome Trust Centre for the History of Medicine at the time, and he had been there. And that's where I really began to understand the value of his work. And I went back to his book just before he died. And he said this, which I thought was quite interesting, that medical ethnologists divide causation theories into ordinary activities gone wrong, or harm wreaked by human or superhuman agency. And he said that early beliefs ascribed special prominence to social or supernatural causes. Illness was thus injury and was linked to aggression. And so I think that this is quite interesting, that somewhere along the way in our sector, we decided this was all about harm, and we really stuck to that belief, come what may. Now, when I started to think about this quite seriously in the 90s and started to work on the book that I published in 2001, I came to this from a different perspective to the one that I think you are coming to it at the moment. And I just want to touch on that for a minute. And that was that trauma, that is lost time injury frequency rates and other measures of injury, work-related injury, were really getting to be so low to not be very motivating as a driver for performance in workplaces. And so this is a graph of a company that was a high performer at the time, not so much these days, who really had pushed their rates right down, as you can see there. And in fact, they recognised this and realised that they need to set new goals and needed to reconceptualise what they were doing. And so they did so. And so this is how I saw this in 2001. I thought we've really got as far as we can go with the harm minimisation model. That is saying what we want is to have an absence of illness or injury. We need to rethink this and we need to move into optimisation of performance and optimisation of productivity. And interestingly, Anne-Marie Fayer, again, quite separately, I don't think she's read my book, came up with this slide quite recently. And I thought it was very interesting, because obviously it's very similar, but there's some words that she's using. I mean, it's a more sophisticated slide. And you can see that she's describing it in gains in company performance and using the phrase organisational health and safety, which I think is a term that we're starting to see coming back into vogue. But there's other good reasons that we need to take this seriously now, and I just want to quickly run through some of the studies that I've been looking at recently to show that that health, chronic illness, is really starting to kick in and have an impact on workers' compensation schemes. James Harrison was out of the blocks very early on this. James runs the Injury Surveillance Unit at Flinders, which is a part of the AIHW, and he did a very interesting report on obesity and workplace injuries. He's one of the few injury epidemiologists that we have in Australia. And you can see here that this report showed that there's a relationship between obesity and musculoskeletal disorders, heat stress, transport accidents, vibration-induced injuries, and that obese patients have longer average length of stay in hospitals, they're more likely to suffer complications of care, and also there may be some troubles in terms of personal protective equipment that they're going to wear. So you can see that we started to see pieces of work like that. But there was a major review published in 2008 which commented on the fact that the relationship between chronic illness and work-related injuries was very thin. So that was in 2008. We've now got more and more studies coming out around this, so it's not completely resolved, but there's some very interesting work, and I'd just like to briefly describe two of them. The first one is one that comes from New Zealand. So much of the things we find inspiring come from New Zealand, don't they? And this is from a health research company working with ACC. John Wren is the person at the ACC that I've been dealing with on this. And what they did in this study was that they examined a wide range of comorbidities, and you'll see those listed down below. So they were really looking at a great many chronic illnesses. And so they recruited people, they recruited practices, they recruited primary care practices, and they ended up with 330,000 people in their sample that came by recruiting the primary care practices. They got the data from the primary care practices, so it wasn't self-reported data, it was a data set that they have for capturing data from primary care. They supplemented that with data from the hospital systems and pathology data and pharmaceutical data, and then they matched that, they linked that with the claims data. They then began to look at over three years, the relationship between chronic illness and having a claim, and then the costs of those claims. So they were able to compare people that had claims that had chronic illness with claims that did not have chronic illness. They also controlled for age, and they controlled for gender, and they controlled for ethnicity. And then they found a completely separate relationship with comorbidities and the claims experience. And it's quite compelling, as you'll see here. So they were, in this study, able to show that one or more health comorbidities showed more claims, so that it affected the risk of injury, higher payments, higher medical costs, and so on. And they estimated that a very large proportion of ACC's costs were related to comorbidities. So they were saying that they thought around 10% of total expenditures could be attributed to the most common comorbidities. So that was one study which really attempted to look at comorbidities in a general sense. So it clumped some comorbidities. The next study, which was being done a little later but would have overlapped in terms of timing, was done in British Columbia. And Peter Smith, who is at Monash at the moment, was the person who filled me in around this important study. And this study was different in that they looked at it from the point of view of age, first of all. But it still was a very large study and was very similar in design. So what they did, instead of starting with primary care data, they started with self-reported data in a community health survey, and then they linked in the data from the hospital system, and then they added the claims data and had a look at what impact having a chronic illness had on the claims experience. But in this study, they really narrowed it down, and they only looked at five health conditions. So they looked at osteoarthritis, diabetes, back pain, hypertension, and coronary heart disease. And they also broke it down and looked at different age groups as well. And they found the same findings, that having a chronic illness had an impact. You had a higher risk of getting a work-related injury, and then once you had been injured, you had longer time off and you had higher costs. But also what they were able to find was that, as well as that, being older was having an impact, and that there were variations in the different conditions. So osteoarthritis and diabetes had the biggest impact, and that there were important differences in the types of injuries that people had at different ages. So they really began to say, clearly there's a very big effect here that we need to take into account, but we really need to understand the mechanism more. We need to know more about the mechanism. I mean, it's not intuitive, you know, why having a chronic illness would increase your risk of a work-related injury. So this study was very good because it drilled down into the detail, and it really exposed that although there's a big effect there, we really don't know enough about the mechanism. So what both studies concluded was, okay, this is real, this is having an effect, you need to get on with prevention now, don't wait for us to sort all of this out or you're going to be in trouble, but you need to keep doing some work to try and understand the mechanisms, is how I interpret where we're up to with regard to that. So we've got to get on with it. What are we going to do about this? Well, as luck would have it, along the way, over the past 20 years, people have been cooking up ways of dealing with this dilemma. And the dilemma is that we can't really separate work-related and non-work-related conditions, and that we need to mix it up and tackle a problem. A health problem in a workplace is a health problem in a workplace, and it's having an impact on productivity. And so this is, again, from my book, The Way That I Saw Things in 2001, a simplistic approach to we need an integrated approach, recognising that in the 90s there was a group in America who were working on this. And so the integrated approach is aiming, it builds on the health protection model, it doesn't replace it. Clearly employers need to provide a safe and healthy working environment. But it says that we really need to aim to improve organisational performance, and in more recent times we're starting to see people writing about broad broader benefits that we need to think about what I've called their social capital gains, but I've probably used the term a bit loosely, Alan, after listening to your presentation this morning, so I'll have another think about that. But up until now, the schemes have really been self-referential. It's as long as we have a positive impact on our cohort of claimants, then that's what we're aiming for, whereas really there's a push now to be saying what are the broader benefits for the community as a whole. In the same way as we expect companies to have social responsibility, we expect schemes to have social responsibility too. So this is how this has evolved over the last 12 years. This is now a model that has been put up by CDC in America, so that includes NIOSH in America, the major institute for occupational health and safety research. And what it's based on a major workshop that was run in 2010 where they attempted to say what's the evidence for improving worker wellbeing in workplaces. And what that found was that interventions need to operate at individual behaviour change level, at the physical environment level, at the policy, psychosocial, environmental level, and they need to link in with the community. And essentially that's what that model says. We need to be doing all of those things if we want to improve wellbeing in the workplace. This is an example from the famous WellWork study, which was run in the 1990s. The WellWork study was about workplace health promotion. It wasn't about occupational health and safety, but already people were thinking about this idea of integrating workplace health and safety, occupational health and safety, and workplace health promotion. And so what they did was they were running a trial where they compared different models, and one of the models was where you had an integrated approach. And they were working on specific conditions. So what they were working on in this example was cancer. So they said instead of dealing with this separately, so instead of doing diet and physical exercise and quit smoking and doing hazardous substances management quite separately, which is what traditionally happens in workplaces, we'll whack this all together. So you see that in the control group, they just did the usual workplace health promotion on smoking and eating and health literacy. But on the other side, they did that, and then they added in the occupational health and safety side, which was managing carcinogens through hazardous substances programs. And what they found was that this was far more effective. This actually had bigger impact on the workplace health promotion outcomes. So it had a bigger impact on making workplace health promotion more effective, because that was the angle that they were looking at it. And there's a very interesting discussion following that, because nobody could really understand why. I mean, it's very interesting. Why would that make such a difference? So they came up with six hypotheses, which are listed here. So one is the perception that OHS risks are a greater threat to health, so everybody takes it more seriously, or that the awareness of risks raises a sense of vulnerability, so people are more interested in health more generally, or that it gives the program more credibility. There's good argument in that in terms of the work that we've been doing more recently in Victoria, that workers see health promotion programs alone as futile, but if OHS risks are addressed, more likely to do their bit too. This is a really important one, and this is the one that I am attracted to. So the idea is that if you come along and you see that your employer is doing a whole lot for your health, to improve your health, it puts the pressure on you a bit to think about your own health. And so we see the very resistant blue-collar males in these programs starting to think about their own health and responsibility. That OHS interventions require more management engagement, and therefore management concern becomes involved in health more generally, and that mitigates fatalism. Or that management engagement just on OHS helps, because you've got senior management lifts the whole profile of what's going on. So again, very interesting discussions about why these work. Most of you would know, and my colleague Pam Anders is going to be speaking about this next, that Victoria showed worldwide innovation with a work health program over the past 5 years, and ISCA did the evaluation for that. One of the interesting things about the evaluation was some modelling that was done, which was to say that if the program had continued, what would we expect the outcomes to be? And the model was based on evidence from the international literature. And Anna Peters did this work, and she said that the international literature on the impact of health promotion programs on compensable injury and illness is not strong. But nevertheless, if we take what we have, then we would have expected to see a reduction of 3 to 5% from the very, in a way, light touch health promotion programs that were occurring. So again, we see this relationship. We don't completely understand it, and the qualitative research out of this evaluation would suggest that that if you do something in OC Health or you do something in workplace health promotion, it actually contributes to a general culture of health safety and wellbeing, which will help everything. So, for example, the Work Health Program didn't explicitly tackle mental wellbeing, but we saw results in the workplaces that did the program, and we saw improved results in mental wellbeing. We've ISCA, I'm not allowed to say we anymore, Liz. ISCA has just completed an evidence review of integrated approaches for WorkSafe. This is not published, so it's really only just coming off the press, and that shows that there's a consistent support of effectiveness from high-quality studies for the integrated approach, and you can see the gains as they're listed here, including return on investment and moderate support, including for improving psychosocial job qualities, demand and control. So some of the big ticket items are there. So note that musculoskeletal disorders, improvement in musculoskeletal disorders and improvement in the quality of the working environment came out as positive. So a concluding statement from NIOSH. NIOSH and WHO have already gone here. We're trailing behind a bit. A growing body of science supports the effectiveness of combining efforts through workplace interventions that integrate health protection and health promotion programs. So thinking about, well, what would this mean if we actually start to do this? What does this mean at a system level? It's all right for workplaces to do it, but what does it mean for schemes? This is quite a dilemma. I went back to basics and thought, well, what are we trying to achieve with workers' comp and what are some recent statements about that? And the industry commission inquiry in 1994, some of you will remember, was a very good piece of work. And so they said that, well, what we're trying to do here is to have a scheme funded by employers because it's appropriate for firms to bear the costs of work-related injury and illness, and then they pass it on in terms of costing, pricing of products. And it also provides an incentive for prevention by firms, and that it's not appropriate for firms to bear the cost of consequences of risks over which they have no control. So if we move into a world where we're managing these issues in an integrated way with regard to prevention, and we have in Australia by and large schemes where prevention and compensation are integrated to create the incentives, then is that going to create a problem? Are we actually going to see an expectation that we will broaden the range of conditions for which people will expect compensation? So I can understand that's an issue, and I'm hoping that's something that we'll discuss in the discussion time this afternoon. So I want to go back to Jane now. So what's Jane been doing? You know, I discovered Jane 1985, writing this PhD, saying we've got a problem here. Well, then I tracked her down because I was so intrigued by her, and I find 30 years on, she's become stunningly famous, and that she's professor who has been leading research into compensation for conditions that have multiple risk factors, so basically for disease. And she's a key professor at Oxford, at the University of Texas and at ANU. And she's 30 years. She's been at this 30 years. So this is a recent paper of hers, and she was criticising a judgment by Lord Phillips on mesothelioma. And this is what Lord Phillips was saying. Where the initiation of the disease is dose-related and there have been consecutive exposures to an agent or agents that cause the disease, one innocent and one tortious, is that how you pronounce it? To rhyme with nauseous? Because where the innocent exposure came first, there may be an issue as to whether this was sufficient to trigger the disease or whether the subsequent tortious exposure contributed to the cause. And she went on to criticise that into what comes first and whether the tortious exposure, all right, we accept that that occurred, but had the damage already been done and so on. And I thought, look, good on you, Jane. It's clear to see you've plugged away with it, but my God, if that's all we've achieved in 30 years, I don't think that we can really afford to wait for the lawyers to solve this for us. So I don't think we're going to get a solution where we can neatly dissect out what's work-related and what's not work-related. I think we'll die waiting for that. And I'm really beginning to wonder, as Paul said this morning, whether we've reached a tipping point and whether with our schemes we're doing more harm than good, and whether we really need to be thinking in a very dramatic way about what we're going to do now with the reality of this situation. And I thought it was just me that was thinking that. And then I went along to our conference that we have at ISCA, and we invited five people to come to the stage and pitch a big idea. And boy, were they interesting ideas. So Michael Borowitz from the ACTU got up and said, return to work's flatline. We need to have a national workers' comp scheme, but why don't we ask the NDIS to do the return to work for us. How's that for an idea, David? And then Carmel Donnelly got up and said, if you actually plot the motor vehicle injuries, you see it looks like an epidemic curve, and we're on the back of the curve now. We've done all the easy stuff. We're in with the difficult stuff. We need to think about schemes that differentiate solutions. It isn't one size fits all, and we need to base what we do on need rather than anything else. And then the health economist from New Zealand got up and said, why don't we just forget all these schemes and just give people what they need, and so on. So I began to realise we're up for it. You know, we're up for thinking about some new ideas. And I think that I think the reason for this is that the reflected light from the NDIS is shining on workers' compensation schemes and exposing us to some things that we've just taken for granted and lived with for a long time, and that the time has come to have another look now we have that light upon us. So my conclusions are, compensation systems are designed for traumatic injuries and have always tolerated a neglect of illness and disease, that chronic illness is rising in the working age population, and there's growing evidence it's having a negative impact on the incidence, which is fascinating, duration and cost of workers' compensation claims, easier to understand. The effect operates at several points. So it's contributing to the increased risk of work injury and illness, the bit that's a bit mystifying. I also think it's arising, leading to recognition of new work-related illness, such that people are starting to make the link with coronary heart disease and type 2 diabetes, for example. It contributes to delayed recovery and increased medical costs. So we need to unpack all of that. Our traditional approaches are not effective for multifactorial conditions, and one of the reasons is that responsibilities are shared by employers and workers. It's a shared responsibility, so we need to rethink the model. And there's good evidence to support the efficaciousness of integrated worker health intervention at the level of workplaces. That's done and dusted. We don't need to do more research on that. What we don't know is how best to implement them at a system level. We really don't know what's an appropriate, efficient and effective role for OHS regulators and workers' compensation schemes, and it's going to look very different, and we need to have a long, hard think about that. So thank you.